truth. Welcome, everyone. And maybe in the merit of anyone who needs a first statement, and the merit of the rabbi's forthcoming shiur on radical emergency on Shabbos. That's right. Let's take a look at a subject that I am especially interested in, which is the question of how you decide if you have to save lives, who comes first? That's a very relevant question for all of us. We need to make that decision, as I'll try to show you. So let me share with you an amazing question that was raised at the Rapid South Africa. We love anything wrong. And let me share with you an insight into this amazing subject. But first of all, let me present you the question itself. This is KFD because, as you well know, in Halakha, questions are answered exactly the way they put. Find differences in the question can make very significant differences to their answer, even in life and death matters. So let's focus carefully on the question, and then we'll take a step back and look at the general subject that's known as triage. Right? Triage means who do you save when you can't save everyone? What we call in Halakha, you can't make it from them. Who comes first? Or who you select when you can't save everyone who needs to be saved. Here's the question. Some years ago, a young surgeon who was training surgery in South Africa found himself in a very peculiar dilemma. He was working at a hospital. I know it's a deep one, South Africa. He found himself working at the Johannesburg Hospital. It's a massive institution. I think it's the biggest hospital in Africa in terms of the actual building. The main building is 1 kilometer long. The main corridor on the ground is the curvature of the earth. And this hospital has a very well developed, what they call an accident service. That is a separate division of the medical department, which deals only with badly injured people. And this young surgeon was doing a rotation through that unit, and the unit had acquired a new machine. But the very sophisticated new ventilator was such that I wasn't there at the time, so I can't tell you the exact technology. But it was something very advanced, and the hospital had only one. And they issued a very peculiar instruction. No doctor on duty would be allowed to use this machine on any patient who is considered to be non-salvageable. Okay? That means if somebody is very badly injured and you can see that they're not going to survive, then don't use the machine at all. Try your best with old technology, keep the machine in the bay, don't use it on that person. Why? Why do you think, what was their reason? Exactly. They were concerned that if you put this new machine on the patient who was hopeless, and half an hour later somebody else arrived who could have been saved, you would not be able to save them because your machine is now the first person. The obvious challenge to them is, why not simply put the first person on the machine by the way? Wait for the second person to come. Switch off the machine on the first person's hopeless anyway, and give it to the second person. Why not? That's not what they said. The hospital said the reason they didn't want to do that was because when you take the machine away from the first person, the family will object, and there'll be scenes of emotion and chaos and hysteria, they didn't want that, so don't get into that in the first place, don't use the machine. Now, usually that's irrelevant. The family's response in that sort of situation, life and death matters, is not relevant. But you are quite correct in what you said. Jewishly, the reason is that if you switch off the machine that someone needs to keep them alive, how much longer, that's called killing the person. Right? And we definitely not allowed to do that. Aim doing nefesh if they nefesh. You can't set aside one life to kill somebody to save someone else. And therefore, we wouldn't be allowed to switch off the machine on the first person, even to save the second. So if we translate this question in Jewish terms, if the first person comes in is not salvageable, and you use the machine on them, somebody will come later, you will not be allowed to switch off the machine on the first person, the second person is going to die. Is it better to keep the machine in the background, do what you can for the first person to die anyway, and use the machine on the second person when they come in? In addition, this young doctor said, and this is critical to remember, he said this hospital is so busy that the scenario is guaranteed. In other words, I can guarantee you, this is not a maybe, this is a guarantee, that if you put the first person on the machine, while they're on it, the second person will come. Now, I'm not going to go into this evening whether in another you can use a statistical guarantee like that. That's not such a simple matter. But let's assume that it is, for purposes of tonight's discussion, if it were clear, not a topic, not a doubt, clear that if you put the machine on the first person, somebody will come later who will not be able to get the machine because the first one has it, is that in fact the correct thing to do? So let's get it here. You come at 8:00 in the morning, you're a good trauma surgeon, you sit there studying your pleasure and stuff, you only like all good trauma surgeons do. And they said, if someone badly injured has been admitted, you rush over and you examine the patient. South African doctors can always tell how long people are going to live. I don't know about English doctors from the coast, but we can always know exactly how long people are going to live. Usually goes to minutes. And you can see this person is what we call a fayei sha'a. That means they are not going to survive. So the hospital says, don't use the machine. If you obey the hospital instructions, you have it ready on the second person to save their life. But if you disobey the hospital instructions, use it on the first person. First of all, you disobey the instruction. That means the doctor might need to tell you, might be disciplined for seeing the consequences. But not only that, a life will be lost in an hour's time when the second person comes in. So he went to one of the world famous halakhic authorities who happened to be in South Africa, and he said, what is my Jewish obligation? Must I obey the instructions and keep the machine in the background to save a life later? Or does the halakha require me to disobey the instructions, use the machine with whatever consequences I have to take? What am I required to do? Now this halakhic authority answered the question. He then sent it on to two other major halakhic authorities. One is by Christ and Shalayim, and they both sent the question to Rabbi Shalayim in their front. In fact, if you want to look it up yourself, you look in the Sitten Eliezer in Chelek Yud 9, Shuba Ayin Beit, he goes into exquisite detail of this question. He did a halakhic question with all the background issues, and Gemara is very fascinating too. But three answers were given to this question, right? And although this is a very clear life and death question, and it's a very clear yes or no answer, in fact there are three completely different answers to this question. And I'd like to show you that the reason for this wide discrepancy, three completely different answers, hangs on the hair's breadth of life and death. Now, let's take a trip through some of the issues of so-called triage, and we'll start to learn the principles and come back and apply them to this text. Please don't look at something that I'm not clear about that. Questions I'm happy to try. Triage, first of all, let me point out to you, is not only an immediate medical situation. You know, you suffer an accident, two people are bleeding. I don't know if people suffer accidents anymore. I know in South Africa they don't because they don't want to get AIDS. In America they don't because they don't want to get sued. They're in England, they're probably sued for life. But people have a brain. You start with an accident, two people are bleeding, this has happened to me as a doctor, I'm sure it's happened to some of you. How do you decide who comes first? But triage is much more than that. You know, for example, let's say you are the director of a hospital and your job is to apportion the budget. Are you allowed to fund a new well-being clinic? You know, where they measure the kids and give you vitamins, if you don't have enough intensive care surgical beds. That's a triage question, right? And at the governmental level, is the country allowed to fund its parks and museums if it doesn't have enough emergency or military facilities? That's also a triage issue, right? That's a big question. You know, the Quran says in the Dorit that if two cities are on a river and there's only enough water in the river, that if the upstream people drink, there'll be enough water for the downstream people to drink. But if the upstream people drink and wash, so they do their laundry, there will be no water at all the downstream people will allow to. If you're a Jew living in an upstream city, are you allowed to wash or must you only drink? What would you say? Drink only, that they do. The Gemara concludes that the people upstream drink and wash. And the reason it gives is because if they don't wash, there'll soon be an outbreak of hygiene-related epidemic among them, whether it's cholera, typhus, we don't exactly know what it is. And although it may not kill them as quickly at first, it will kill them just as surely, and you can take that into account. So it's a very broad issue, Marshall. Here's another one. 3 years ago, there was a couple in certain European cities. For many years, found themselves unable to have children. They ended up at a hospital that has a very efficient fertility unit, and it ends up having a child. The father of this child is an exceptionally wealthy individual, and he made a massive donation to this celebrity hospital, stipulating that the money goes to help other people have children. So this was his very situation. So the hospital director says, well, I'm not taking your money for that. We've got no urgent need. We need emergency facilities here. And because then the family life comes first. You have no right to help people have children when there are other people in the world who are ill. We need to be saved. So the man said, I'm not giving my money. So where's the obligation? You know, instead of just taking the money, you know, it's sort of like one of the children who was from South Africa, you know, he was going through a situation like that. He had a friend who was exceptionally generous and very wealthy, very generous, but Jewishly a little challenged. This friend once made a promise to Mono Vicharov that he'd give him enough money to build an entire yeshiva on condition that the Rock promised that the students wouldn't have to wear these. So the Rock promised, took the money, and he built the bad chapels. But on this occasion, the man, so they went to Rabbi Yashik, and Rabbi Yashik ruled that the man is allowed to give his money to the facility service. So the hospital director said, but that doesn't make any sense to go and manage. Now you have to be very broad shouldered, and like a giant. So Rabbi Yashik said, a country needs a normal spread of facilities. If you start funding only emergencies, people get an embattled mentality, that affects the law, and that's also like a message. Or you have to be very big to be able to manage. But you get the situation. If you're not the other hospital, you're not in Italy, the hospital run according to Hanukkah. So some years ago, a wealthy American gave a kidney dialysis machine to the hospital on condition that it's only allowed to be used for tourists. Because he was concerned that if somebody had kidney failure, they said America, they want to visit Israel, there's no way they can visit Israel. No one's going to dialyze in a country that doesn't have enough facilities. So put this machine in. Anyone visiting Israel will travel around the country every 2 or 3 days to pass through the Tanya, sleep overnight on the machine. Between the island, they'll go back to the room. Well, you know what happened? They put the machine in. Shortly thereafter, the person arrived in Kitty Family with another tourist. They went to the rabbi, the Tanya McGrady, and he said, you've got never used the machine. So now it's used the whole time. Do not ask me what would happen if a tourist and non-tourist arrive at the same time. I have no idea. But these are the kinds of situations, and Trio is very, very broad and complicated. Here we go. Not just a question of two people who need to be there. But let's spend a few moments looking at the emergency situation of two people. Imagine you have two people here. These are both very desperately ill people. I walk into the room, I see both of them dying, I can only say one. What's the first criteria we apply trying to decide who to say?
Yes,
Yada is not an issue, there's actually an interesting argument about this, the Yada talks about that. Should you say the old one or the younger? It's a complicated question. I saw it mentioned, in fact, there was a young kidney doctor specialist in South Africa also, who was running an islander program. And he was selecting people for the islanders and transplants according to the normal criteria. And young people get it before old people. In fact, the young person gets it before the old one, and a person with only one disease, namely kidney disease, gets it before a person who has many medical problems. And this young doctor went to ask a certain rabbi there, he says, I've just realized if I use those criteria, I will dialyze an 18-year-old young fellow who has only kidney disease. And a 45-year-old man who's got kidney and heart disease will not get dialyzed. But what if the 18-year-old is a single fellow and the 45-year-old man is 45 people? Oh, it gets very messy. How do you decide? You know, in 1948 in Israel, there was a need for a volunteer for an exceptionally difficult mission. And the commander sent an emergency message to Chazanish. Should I send a married or an unmarried man? The man probably ends up. Who should I choose, married or unmarried? What would you say?
Unmarried.
The Chazanish sent a married man who is already fulfilled the list of having children. Anyway, so age is not really criterion. Anything else?
Yes.
It's obviously not feminist, yes, right? Gender sex? Okay, these are all these things are discussed. But in fact, the first criterion is the one that's closer to me. The one that's physically closer to me, although you equalize the sex. What's the reason? You're not allowed to bypass the mitzvah. So you've got two equivalent mitzvahs. You can't bypass one to get to an equivalent or distant mitzvah, right? That's pretty much the first criteria. In fact, the Rashi writing says it's going to take precedence over the more imperious things about men first, women first, someone with more mitzvahs, someone with less mitzvahs, a coat, a lady, a throat. This is what you do. In fact, in Hadassah Hospital in 1949 or thereabouts, there were 8 children with meningitis. Now, back in those days, when penicillin had just come out, there was almost certain guaranteed cure for the kids, but they had only enough for 2. 8 children with meningitis, only enough medicine for 2. And without the medicine, it was almost certain the children would not survive. The doctors didn't know how to decide which 2 children to give to. They went to Chief Rabbi Herzog, not often in Israel, the rabbis are not, unfortunately, but they did. Rabbi Herzog came to Moshe Feinstein in New York. I heard from somebody who was present that the phone call took 15 seconds. And Moshe said, tell the doctors to walk in and give it to the first 2 children. So I heard someone say, well, what about the minority? It's boy, it's girl, it's not relevant. The first child gets the first dose, the second child gets the second dose, and then you're supposed to be the other one. So who is physically closer? That is one of the most important criteria, and in fact, that's most probably the most basic, although there are many others. Whether women come first or men come first, there's a discussion about this. And many, the one says that in a captivity situation, women have to be running from back first before men. Right? The reason is not because they are better or worse for, the reason is because the women may be sexually interfered with, which is not true of the men, and therefore it's not fair, it's not all about being equal. The Shulchan Aruch writes that if the terrorists are homosexuals, then you have to save the men. Because that's a great idea. And therefore that's the but all else being equal, sex, gender is not an issue. And that's your wife. If it's your wife captured, then how do you provide a human hire the terrorists in the first place? Because as you know, in our own you have to take your wife, captivity, fines, burial expenses, medical bills, inheritance for the children from unexpected family, and all of it. Anyway, so now, first one, now, one of the people walking from here, they're both married, one's your brother and one's a stranger. Who comes first?
Brother.
Do you have a brother? Who comes first?
Brother,
right? Now, why does your brother come first? Because your mother will be upset? Why did your brother come first? I don't want somebody else to brother. Mitzvah al-Hitam. You must allow to enjoy your flesh, and therefore all else being equal. And the first thing to say is this applies also to a friend or even a neighbor. And it's the same rule that we apply here in Stockholm. You have to give family members first, Stockholm. In fact, if your parents come first, first thing to say that if the parents in Stockholm can give you more than 50% of your mindset, even though it's a bunch of not so narrowly give more than 50% to any particular corner. If the parents after their grandparents, there's a hierarchy of people who should get them out there. And it's well known, of course, that come when you have a relationship with, for example, you have to give your stock of money to people in your town before people who live different cities. From Jewish and non-Jewish causes, because there are devolving layers, concentric layers of responsibility, except for Israel. You can equally prioritize Jews who live in Jerusalem, and some say all of Israel, because that's every Jewish city, not only where you live. So there are layers of responsibility, and therefore, but one of them is that someone related to you comes first. So we start by alpha. Now, apply your black belt halakhic mind. What's the next question I'm going to ask you? Someone make my day. That's an interesting, it's not the next one. That's excellent, it's not the next question. Anyone trained halakhically will now ask an obvious question.
The following one?
By the way, your following one, who comes first?
Jew or non-Jew?
Let me make it more obvious. Listen carefully. I walk in from here, I have to treat the first person, right? I walk in from here, and they both, every distance that one's related, I have to treat the rest of the person. What's the next question that must be asked? Person, this is an interesting halakhic exercise. The bottom line of what you're going to do now, you can think about the follow up, and the one you're going to write, you'll have that in the Bible. The answer is you bypass the closest person, and you get to the person who's related to you. Passing by the obligation of Adam and Eve, this is not a simple halakhic exercise about why that is, but I'm not going to go into that now. But in fact, you bypass the closest person and treat your people. Now, what is this? They're both equidistant, neither one's related to you. And one similarly ill could not survive. Chayei shock. And one is a chayei freila, that means could live normally. For purposes of this discussion, most folks can say that's with a year. What we call terminal Jewish law. for this discussion. He's interesting, there are versions for it and discussed and debated, but a very good working group that was responsible and others talk about it, is that somebody who could not survive for a year due to some process that is now illness that they have, that is called a high shock. So if this person could not survive, and this person could, for example, let's say this person has some disease that will not allow him to survive for a year, this person has none. But they're probably now bleeding dangerously, because they haven't acted, right? So in 10 minutes, neither one will be alive. But if I save this one, he'll die in 3 months' time anyway from his disease. If I save this one, he will live normally more than a year. So all being healthy, which one do I say?
One is going to live long.
I don't know, right? That's true. It's the same one who could live for more. By the way, what happens if both are the same person? Example, this is a very common situation. Somebody has a disease that is guaranteed to take their life in 2 years. We can offer them a risky procedure that is successful will save their life, but if it fails, will kill them immediately. Deprive them of the 3 months, or the 6 months, or the 9 months they will get. Are you allowed to take such a risk?
Yes.
He may or may not be a trained, by the way.
Wow.
No, 12 months is a trained,
but
one of
18
is
all or nothing.
Yeah. So we'll make a difference. A trained would not live for a year. That's not the definition. That's right, you've got to be careful. Okay, but
can
you take
your risk?
Of a guaranteed demise within a year, he's allowed to take a very risky option to save his life. Most poetry, not all, but most modern authorities say even a bigger than 50% risk. The most fun thing certainly holds to be 10%, some say 100,000 even. This is the basic issue what the level of risk is. But the modern authorities hold, based on the climate data, that many often, that even if you're talking to the survival of this operation, let's say, on less than 50%, if the alternative is 100% guarantee that you can do for a year, you can risk the 3 months or whatever it was, even with 72 years. In fact, the language of the law makes it apparent that that is the proper thing to do, for example, if it's a child or an unconscious person, or else the eagle would probably would choose that for the greater chance of damaging it. Okay, so now you have the one who's ability, the one who cannot, we're saving the life of one. Now, what happens if you walk in from here? The closer person could not do it. They will lie a shot. If you bypass them, you'll get your diarrhea and save your life. But you have to bypass them instead, yes.
When here comes our key and the stuff-naming issue needs to be very clearly understood. Look what's happening.
And what we pass the person who's going to live for 3 months or 9 months, right? If he was the only one in the room, I would give him all my attention. I mean, there are exceptions, but he's not there for a long time. There are exceptions to the time we can talk about. But let's assume normally I would help this person live another 3 months or 6 months or 9 months. Why am I allowed to ignore that obligation? Because I have someone who's a woman. Here comes the key. Whenever you bypass a halakhic obligation to save a life, there's one massive condition that needs to be satisfied. The person's life you're trying to save must be here now. That's called a fayda lit by name. This goes back to a fascinating shuba of the Rebbe, you heard it? Written in fact to doctors in London. Doctors in London in 1780, they wrote in the Rebbe, they said, we have a patient with some neurological or bladder problem who died. We want to do a post-mortem on the person to get information to save other people in the future. Now, post-mortem is usually thought very problematic. Very strong prohibition could be involved in a post-mortem. But, obviously, we will do that for your marriage. So, can we do this post-mortem on the person's life? Those of you said, if other people have the same problem, immediately, that means there's a real and present danger to other people, then you can transgress the issue of the post-mortem. But if it's knowledge to be gained that may save lives in the future, that's not acceptable Allah. A khayla lefanen, the other sentence is the same thing, and that's the same thing. You need somebody here now. That's example. You're a doctor in the hospital, you get a patient with a very weird disease. They've got yellow squares all over their body, they're flashing like a neuron. That's great. Suddenly the person's up. Ooh, all the doctors want to do a post-mortem, get their hands on their liver and sleep. Nothing new in the Jewish world. Can't do a post-mortem. Disgrading the body, maybe forcing to sacrifice the non-Jewish bodies as well. You can't do that, you prepare the person for burial. Suddenly the patient is left there, gets yellow squares. You start flashing. You go find the first person now, and you're obliged to do a post-mortem now. Why? Because you have another person who may be in danger, who you may be able to help. No, all the doubts in the world are here. We don't use majority when it comes to life saving. So even though it's not certain that there is danger, and even if it's not certain that you're helping, you can break shutters, you can do a post-mortem, whatever you need, because there's a real person who may be in danger, whom you may save. There's one exception in our life. We don't use majority. You know, if you come to Rabbi and you say, I was cooking a meat soup, and a couple of bills fell through accidentally, the Rabbi will tell you, if it was accidental, under certain circumstances, you eat the soup. In fact, if you think you're being very cruel, if you throw it out, you're guilty of wasting. Because majority is not minority. Not in life saving. When it comes to life saving, any amount of minority is not a null in the majority, right? That's what you want to say clearly. You don't apply majorities when it comes to life saving. By the way, this is an extreme rule. I'll just tell you one incredible example. Here's an incredible example. Let's say you're walking out of the empty, lost in the water, and you walk past a garbage can and you hear a baby cry. You open the lid and you find an abandoned newborn child. What's one of the obvious questions that will bother you? That's one question. One question that's going to crop up is it Jewish? Is it Jewish baby, right? You need a prince, you need to pay kosher food. How do you decide if an abandoned baby is Jewish or not? The requirement says you supply majority. If the child's found in an area where the majority of residents are Jewish, it's a Jewish child. If it's found in a majority non-Jewish area, it's a non-Jewish child. Now listen carefully. If you find this baby in a non-Jewish area, I don't know, Brisbane, some non-Jewish area, you find you find a child with a very few Jews. What do? You gently and tenderly hand the kid over to the local non-Jewish orphanage and take care of the child. 10 years later, you find out the child's life is aged. The Jewish community has to go and save it. Isn't that amazing? Because he's not Jewish by majority. So that doesn't apply to your marriage. Very terrible. So when it comes to life saving, we don't use majority. Amazing thing, right? So, but you need a real person. So to do a post-mortem or break shutters or anything else like that, you could do it. Or you need a real and present danger. Like 1 year of building is tolerated in everything. And he's also not to call everybody to eat on your kippah. And people didn't want to. He got up in shul and he gave Katie one. I'm saying make kiddush, I'm not the rabbi, and you do or don't make kiddush. Which is the base in our life, and maybe get a cheap filler or not. But he had faith and wine in shul to show people there's a danger, a real danger to real people right now. You eat. They say, like a woman brought the chicken to him because the chef said, wouldn't kill the chicken if it was your kipper. And the doctor said, the son, urgently needed his child. He took the chicken right to the man and said, please, the son. No time to wait, right? Okay. So you need a real person whose life is injured, then you are okay.
Now, here comes the question. What causes of energy? Why has it been in front of us? Same room, same hospital, same city. What is Lipan Ann? And those of you who make this claim that Lipan Ann doesn't mean geographical proximity, it means a real existence person who needs to be saved. The classic modern application of that is transplantation. In England today, the way transplants are done is, let's say kidneys, I won't say they're shooting in the cell or around the area, but let's say kidneys are taken in the Royal Free Hospital tomorrow morning. The doctors taking the kidneys don't know who's going to get them. But there's a national computerized matching program. And there are many recipients waiting for organs. So somebody may be burying tomorrow night going to get a kidney. That's not the dynamic. The problem is not where he is. The problem is there's a real person who needs to be saved. That's called the body. And therefore, that is the criteria. Here's an extreme example. 1986, there was a baby born in Long Beach, California. Child had heart disease. The baby would die. There was no hope other than trying a heart transplant for this child. The problem was that it had never been done before. Let me remind you that heart transplantation only began in 1968. This is a country we need to get But by 1986, nobody had ever tried to transplant a heart into a baby. The surgeon happened to be Jewish, a famous surgeon by the name of Ron Shumway, and he decided for the first time to try to take his baby back from a transplant because he was not a heart. The problem was, where do you find a heart for transplantation for a baby? Very, very hard to do. They scoured the United States and they found a child available to be a donor in Vermont. But Vermont is 3,000 miles away from California. But there was no other. So they hired a private jet. They put one of the young surgeons in the team to this private jet. They flew him across America to Vermont, where he excited the heart of the child in Vermont and put it into a box of cold cardio leaching solution, and they couldn't get the jet to start. They ended up scrambling the United States Air Force supersonic fighter with a terrified young surgeon in the back who was a supersonic fighter the heart of the when they got back to California, they had to start the surgeon. But they did, and they saved the life of the baby in California. That's called the financial. Why? For 6,000 miles is not a problem. There was a real person who needed to be saved. Okay, so for the good. Okay, let's come back to our question. And together we're going to solve that. Right. So let's get it here. 8 o'clock in the morning, you come on duty, you've got your very bad injured patient. You can see he's not going to survive. Only hours a day or two. Here's your new pain on the machine. You'd like to put the machine on the patient, right? So let's assume you're about to do that, but as you're about to put the machine on, you hear the door open, you look up, and you see they're wheeling in another person who is salvaged. This person is Chaye Shah, they could not do it. That person is Chaye Vela. If you wait a few seconds and get that person here and use the machine on them, they're loose. Do you wait for the person to get here from the door? Excellent. He's completely unconscious, this person. He's so badly injured, he's about to die, he doesn't know what's happening. Do you wait? Yes. He's from the door to here called the Panel. Yes. Scenario number two. And in the morning, come on duty, very bad injured person, about to put the machine on. The phone rings. On the phone, they tell you that the ambulance is on its way. 10 miles away is the ambulance. It's a very badly injured person who's a Chaye Vela who survived. Wait 10 minutes, he'll be here. Do you wait?
Yes.
Is 10 miles to Panel?
Yes.
Brilliant. Number three. And in the morning, badly injured person, about to put the machine on. The radio crackles enough. And on the radio, they tell you that the helicopter is 150 miles away. And had a Chaye Vela, a salvageable person, you wait an hour, the helicopter will be here. You wait?
Yeah.
150 miles on the phone here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen carefully. And if this doesn't move you, it's not okay. So listen well. And in the morning, you come on duty, very bad injured person, you're about to put the machine on. No disturbance, no phone call, no radio call. Okay, there's a physical guarantee. Then half an hour later, someone is going to be here. Is a statistical that my name is called the name? We have to enjoy the question. What do you call that? On the one hand, there's someone here. On the other hand, you guarantee somebody will be here. On the one hand, there's nobody even exists at the station. You know where he is? He's muckling at his wife from behind the newspaper at the breakfast table. Not knowing that he's going to run into a truck on the highway. But he is. In Shemaine, they're looking down and saying, you're in trouble today. So there's no human patient yet, but there will be. You see, I would say we do a hakira. Hakira means it looks like
flip a neighbor, usually conflates two different issues. The person in front of you is life will be safe. In this weird situation, you have no one in front of you, but a life will be safe. If I put the machine on the person now, who's going to die anyway, 45 minutes later, this person is going to arrive, who's not a patient, they're going to move, and someone's going to die today. What's the concern of the one is? Having someone here, or knowing will take a life?
Lack of knowledge.
Let me tell you what happened and how this question was answered, and I'll stop in case you have any questions. The first authority who answered this question, Rav Moshe Sternberg, who was asked the question, he said to the same doctor, so I understand the hospital was correct. You know, to do your job, hold the machine in the bag, do the best you can for the first person, for the second person comes in, then you put the real questions on. And of course, since he was given his track that way, that's what comes. Although the question was said to others, you know, if you ask your rabbi a question, if you ask your rabbi an opinion, you don't have to say anything. When you're asking yourself, you go to the rabbi and say, this is chicken kosher. Whatever he says, you've got to shop around, you can't go ask somebody else. You know that. You can ask your rabbi an opinion and make up your own mind. But if you ask for a fact, you round that. You can't shop around, right? So since you know there's a joke about it, you know the Bari Lan CD ROM. Bari Lan University has a CD ROM. It says every halakhi question that's ever been asked. The joke about it is you ask it what you want to hear, and it tells you who to ask. That's wrong, okay? So, he was given his fact, and of course that's what Rabbi did. Now there were two other answers to the question. Rabbi in Yerushalayim said, I disagree, I don't think that's all the problem. The first person gets the issue. What happens in an hour from now you have to deal with it? And Rabbi Yerushalayim is very right because Rabbi Yerushalayim is son-in-law, and the privilege many years ago compared to the shoe that he gives to Dr. Israel, he said, neither of those are correct. Guess what you mean? The second you're playing on the shoe, you attach to it a clock and a bell. And this is what you do. As soon as the first person arrives, no matter how bad he is, right away you put him on the machine and set it running. Half an hour later, it brings the bell to warn you and switches off automatically. You quickly switch it on again and continue running. Half an hour later, it switches off, you switch it on again. You keep doing that until the second person arrives. When the second person arrives, wait for the machine to switch on automatically, and instead of starting it on them, start on the second. Whether the Johannesburg Hospital would like shuttle trucks to do that, I don't know. But this is seriously being considered. In fact, I had the honor of speaking to the ethics committee in Columbia University a few months ago. They told me they are now seriously considering putting prime cutoffs on their ICU ventilators. Why? Because many people come to intensive care and they refuse to ventilate. Why? They're afraid that if they put them on a machine, I'll never get them off. And if they can never get them off, they won't have those machines for other people who could have been saved. So unfortunately, lots of people don't get ventilated. So rather than have that unfortunate situation, this way we'll put everybody on a machine. But they'll cover for the 90. Those who recover will recover. Those who don't recover will simply wait for the machine strip. And then we'll start them on other people who could. This is not a simple matter, hasn't been implemented yet, been hotly debated in the medical world and in the halakhic world, but that is a potential direction. Okay, this is a summary of some of the issues involved in Kadiva and Kira. If you have any questions that I can answer, I'm happy to try. Hmm. Sure. Thank you. that everyone is sinners, not just God. Unfortunately, we live in a world today where this has been a tremendous insult to this area. You know that in England today, many elderly people, and people are very ill, are just not being fed. They just put out feeding tubes, and they just start to be outraged at this, completely against. Sometimes not even with the patient's permission or the family's agreement. It's a very widespread practice now. Under what circumstances can you stop treating each other? So in a nutshell, it's a long subject, but very brief. The first one, the person must be terminally ill, which means I might be within a year. Two, suffering uncontrollably, which should never happen in modern age. And three, under those circumstances, does not want to continue. Or, four, will stay stunned, permanently unconscious, with no hope of ever regaining consciousness, and would not want to continue in those circumstances. In those circumstances, terminal illness, suffering uncontrollably or irreversible karma, would not want to continue. In those circumstances, the Dharma Shamati, you're not allowed to continue treating. You're simply prolonging the suffering. But that only applies to treatment. It never applies to staple needs, withdrawing feeding, liquid, oxygen, any basic need that the person needed ordinarily to keep going. Insulin, say diabetic, most points to say blood products, and antibodies as well. Those cannot be stopped, that's not allowed. But anything extraordinary that adds to their suffering, a lot of surgery, chemotherapy, that they don't want, that is a question we will not be able to do. But normal things that the person has on their knees, that we already start to consult people to do. I mean, normal arguments, right? I mean, absolutely. That's it. No,
4 hours, around the clock. Stop to watch the
What do you mean torturing an unconscious patient? It's not something. You mean to make a new suffering. And a family of suffering. But the patient doesn't know she's unconscious. So it's not to make her better, not to live in her life. The fact that she's 100 is not, that's all that's about. I think you absolutely have to watch this like a whole. I can tell you terrible stories about this, and it's getting worse. In some countries it's legal. In Belgium, in Holland, they can actually terminate people's lives. Many American doctors now admit to actually actively. They think they're doing it, that's a really, you know. Yeah.
If the third person that you come to in the room is not serious, that there is zero danger of anybody else outside of the room seeing what you're doing, hey, do you stay the Jewish person?
Yeah, definitely
come
first. And the simplest reason in terms of what that's in mind is that they're related. The problem is that this would be problematic if you're in a hospital setting where you're not allowed to keep that sort of problem. By the way, because the family members will be involved there. If you employed in a hospital, okay, where it's clearly against the rules that we take on, you'd be very close trouble with saving your relatives before non-residents, right? Because you work in the environment that makes that very problematic. If you're in a dense company, certainly your relationship comes first, and a Jew certainly comes first. Yeah, any final questions? Okay, let me do this.